Chapter 8. The knowledge that he would be sharing his office again on Monday added piquancy to Strike's weekend solitude, rendering it less irksome, more valuable. The camp bed could stay out, the door between inner and outer offices could remain open. He was able to attend to bodily functions without fear of causing offence. Sick of the smell of artificial limes, he managed to force open the painted shut window behind his desk, which allowed a cold, clean breeze to wipe the fusty corners of the two small rooms. Avoiding every CD, every track that transported him back to those excruciating, exhilarating periods he had shared with Charlotte, he selected Tom Waits to play loudly on the small CD player he had thought he would never see again, and which he had found at the bottom of one of the boxes he had brought from Charlotte's. He busied himself setting up his portable television with its paltry indoor aerial. He loaded his worn clothes into a black bin bag and walked to a laundrette half a mile away. Back at the office, he hung up his shirts and underwear on a rope he slung across one side of the inner office, then watched the 3 o'clock match between Arsenal and Spurs. Through all these mundane acts, he felt as though he was accompanied by the spectre that had haunted him during his months in hospital. It lurked in the corners of his shabby office. He could hear it whispering to him whenever his attention on the task in hand grew slack. It urged him to consider how far he had fallen, his age, his penury, his shattered love life, his homelessness. 35, it whispered, and nothing to show for all your years of graft except a few cardboard boxes and a massive debt. The spectre directed his eyes to cans of beer in the supermarket, where he bought more pot noodles. It mocked him as he ironed shirts on the floor. As the day wore on, it jeered at him for his self-imposed habit of smoking outside in the street, as though he was still in the army, as though this petty self-discipline could impose form and order on the amorphous, disastrous present. He began to smoke at his desk, with the butts mounting in a cheap tin ashtray he had swiped long ago from a bar in Germany. But he had a job, he kept reminding himself, a paid job. Arsenal beat Spurs, and Strike was cheered. He turned off the television, and defying the spectre, moved straight to his desk and resumed work. At liberty now to collect and collate evidence in whatever way he chose, Strike continued to conform to the protocols of the Criminal Procedure and Investigation Act. The fact that he believed himself to be hunting a figment of John Bristow's disturbed imagination made no difference to the thoroughness and accuracy with which he now wrote up the notes he had made during his interviews with Bristow, Wilson, and Colovis Jones. Lucy telephoned him at 6 in the evening while he was hard at work. Though his sister was younger than Strike by 2 years, she seemed to feel herself older. Weighed down young by a mortgage, a stolid husband, 3 children and an onerous job, Lucy seemed to crave responsibility, as though she could never have enough anchors. Strike had always suspected that she wanted to prove to herself and the world that she was nothing like their fly-by-night mother, who had dragged the two of them all over the country, from school to school, house to squat to camp, in pursuit of the next enthusiasm or man. Lucy was the only one of his 8 half-siblings with whom Strike had shared a childhood. He was fonder of her than of almost anyone else in his life, and yet their interactions were often unsatisfactory, laden with familiar anxieties and arguments. Lucy could not disguise the fact that her brother worried and disappointed her. In consequence, Strike was less inclined to be honest with her about his present situation than he would have been with many a friend. "Yeah, it's going great," he told her, smoking at the open window, watching people drift in and out of the shops below. "Business has doubled lately."
"Where are you? I can hear traffic."
"At the office. I've got paperwork to do."
"On Saturday? How does Charlotte feel about that?"
"She's away. She's gone to visit her mother."
"How are things going between you?"
"Great," he said.
"Are you sure?"
"Yeah, I'm sure. How's Greg?"
She gave him a brief précis of her husband's workload, then returned to the attack.
"Is Gillespie still on your back for repayment?"
"Nope.
Because you know what, Stick?
The childhood nickname boded ill. She was trying to soften him up.
I've been looking into this, and you could apply to the British Legion for...
Fucking hell, Lucy, he said,
before he could stop himself.
What?
The hurt and indignation in her voice were only too familiar. He closed his eyes.
I don't need help from the British Legion, Luce, all right?
There's no need to be so proud.
How are the boys?
They're fine. Look, Stick, I just think it's outrageous that Ropey's getting his lawyer to hassle you when he's never given you a penny in his life. He ought to have made it a gift, seeing what you've been through and how much he's...
Business is good. I'm going to pay off the loan, said Strike.
A teenage couple on the corner of the street were having an argument.
Are you sure everything's all right between you and Charlotte? Why is she visiting her mother? I thought they hated each other.
They're getting on better these days, he said,
as the teenage girl gesticulated wildly, stamped her foot and walked away.
Have you bought her a ring yet?
Asked Lucy.
I thought you wanted me to get Gillespie off my back.
Is she all right about not having a ring?
She's been great about it, said Strike. She says she doesn't want one. She wants me to put all my money into the business.
Really?
Said Lucy. She always seemed to think that she made a good job of dissimulating her deep dislike of Charlotte.
Are you going to come to Jack's birthday party?
When is it?
I sent you an invitation over a week ago, Stick.
He wondered whether Charlotte had slipped it into one of the boxes he had left unpacked on the landing, not having room for all his possessions in the office.
Yeah, I'll be there, he said.
There was little he wanted to do less. The call terminated, he returned to his computer and continued work. His notes from the Wilson and Colovis-Jones interviews were soon completed, but a sense of frustration persisted. This was the first case that he had taken since leaving the army that required more than surveillance work, and it might have been designed to remind him daily that he had been stripped of all power and authority. Film producer Freddie Bastigui, the man who had been in closest proximity to Lula Landry at the time of her death, remained unreachable behind his faceless minions, and in spite of John Bristow's confident assertion that he would be able to persuade her to talk to Strike, there was not yet a secured interview with Tansy Bastigui. With a faint sense of impotence, and with almost as much contempt for the occupation as Robin's fiancé felt for it, Strike fought off his lowering sense of gloom by resorting to more internet searches connected with the case. He found Kieran Colovis-Jones online. The driver had been telling the truth about the episode of the bill in which he had had two lines. Gang member two, Kieran Colovis-Jones. He had a theatrical agent too, whose website featured a small photograph of Kieran and a short list of credits including walk-on parts in EastEnders and Casualty. Kieran's photograph on the exec car's homepage was much larger. Here he stood alone in a peaked hat and uniform, looking like a film star, evidently the handsomest driver on their books. Evening shaded into night beyond the windows. While Tom Waits growled and moaned from the portable CD player in the corner, Strike chased the shadow of Lula Landry across cyberspace, occasionally adding to the notes he had already taken while speaking to Bristow, Wilson, and Colovis-Jones. He could find no Facebook page for Landry, nor did she ever seem to have joined Twitter. Her refusal to feed her fans' ravenous appetite for personal information seemed to have inspired others to fill the void. There were countless websites dedicated to the reproduction of her pictures and to obsessive commentary on her life. If half of the information here was factual, Bristow had given Strike but a partial and sanitized version of his sister's drive towards self-destruction, a tendency which seemed to have revealed itself first in early adolescence when her adoptive father, Sir Alec Bristow, a genial-looking bearded man who had founded his own electronics company, Albris, had dropped dead of a heart attack. Lula had subsequently run away from two schools and been expelled from a third, all of them expensive private establishments. She had slit her own wrist and been found in a pool of blood by a dormitory friend. She had lived rough and been tracked to a squat by the police.
A fan site called LulaMyInspirationForever.com, run by a person of unknown sex, asserted that the model had briefly supported herself during this time as a prostitute. Then had come sectioning under the Mental Health Act, the secure ward for young people with severe illnesses, and a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Barely a year later, while shopping in a clothing store on Oxford Street with her mother, there had come the fairy tale approach from a scout for a modelling agency. Landry's early photographs showed a 16-year-old with the face of Nefertiti, who managed to project to the lens an extraordinary combination of worldliness and vulnerability, with long thin legs like a giraffe's and a jagged scar running down the inside of her left arm that fashion editors seemed to have found an interesting adjunct to her spectacular face, for it was sometimes given prominence in photographs. Lula's extreme beauty was on the very edge of absurdity, and the charm for which she was celebrated, in both newspaper obituaries and hysterical blogs, sat alongside a reputation for sudden outbursts of temper and a dangerously short fuse. Press and public seemed to have both loved her and loved loathing her. One female journalist found her strangely sweet, possessed of an unexpected naivety. Another, at bottom, a calculating little diva, shrewd and tough. At 9 o'clock, Strike walked to Chinatown and bought himself a meal. Then he returned to the office, swapped Tom Waits for Elbow, and searched out online accounts of Evan Duffield, the man who, by common consent, even that of Bristow, had not killed his girlfriend. Until Kieran Colovis-Jones had displayed professional jealousy, Strike could not have said why Duffield was famous. He now discovered that Duffield had been elevated from obscurity by his participation in a critically acclaimed independent film, in which he had played a character indistinguishable from himself, a heroin-addicted musician stealing to support his habit. Duffield's band had released a well-reviewed album on the back of their lead singer's newfound fame, and split up in considerable acrimony around the time that he had met Lula. Like his girlfriend, Duffield was extraordinarily photogenic. Even in the unretouched, long-lens photographs of him sloping along a street in filthy clothes, even in those shots, and there were several, where he was lunging in fury at photographers. The conjunction of these two damaged and beautiful people seemed to have supercharged the fascination with both, each reflecting more interest onto the other, which rebounded on themselves. It was a kind of perpetual motion. The death of his girlfriend had fixed Duffield more securely than ever in that firmament of the idolised, the vilified, the deified. A certain darkness, a fatalism, hung around him. Both his most fervent admirers and his detractors seemed to take pleasure in the idea that he had one booted foot in the afterworld already, that there was an inevitability about his descent into despair and oblivion. He seemed to make a veritable parade of his frailties, and Strike lingered for some minutes over another of those tiny, jerky YouTube videos in which Duffield, patently stoned, talked on and on, in the voice Colovis-Jones had so accurately parodied, about dying being no more than checking out of the party, and making a confused case for there being little need to cry if you had to leave early. On the night that Lula had died, according to a multitude of sources, Duffield had left the nightclub shortly after his girlfriend, wearing, and Strike found it hard to see this as anything other than deliberate showmanship, a wolf's mask. His account of what he had got up to for the rest of the night might not have satisfied online conspiracy theorists, but the police seemed to have been convinced that he had had nothing to do with subsequent events at Kentigern Gardens. Strike followed the speculative train of his own thoughts over the rough terrain of news sites and blogs. Here and there he stumbled upon pockets of feverish speculation, of theories about Landry's death that mentioned clues the police had failed to follow up, and which seemed to have fed Bristow's own conviction that there had been a murderer. Lula, My Inspiration Forever, had a long list of unanswered questions, which included, at number 5, who called off the paps before she fell? At number 9, why did the men with the covered faces running away from her flat at 2 a.m. never come forward? Where are they, and who were they? And at number 13, why was Lula wearing a different outfit to the one she came home in when she fell off the balcony? Midnight found Strike drinking a can of lager and reading about the posthumous controversy that Bristow had mentioned, of which he had been vaguely aware while it unfolded, without being very interested. A furore had sprung up a week after the inquest had returned a verdict of suicide around the advertising shot for the wares of designer Guy Sommet. It featured two models posing in a dirty alleyway, naked except for strategically placed handbags, scarves and jewels. Landry was perched on a dustbin, Kiara Porter sprawled on the ground. Both wore huge curving angel's wings. Porter's a swan-like white, Landry's a greenish-black, fading to glossy bronze. Strike stared at the picture for minutes, trying to analyse precisely why the dead girl's face drew the eye so irresistibly, how she managed to dominate the picture. Somehow, she made the incongruity, the staginess of it, believable. She really did look as though she had been slung from heaven because she was too venal, because she so coveted the accessories she was clutching to herself. Kiara Porter, in all her alabaster beauty, became nothing but a counterpoint. In her pallor and her passivity, she looked like a statue. The designer, Guy Sommet, had drawn much criticism upon himself, some of it vicious, for choosing to use the picture. Many people felt that he was capitalising on Landry's recent death, and sneered at the professions of deep affection for Landry that Sommet's spokesman made on his behalf. Lula, my inspiration forever, however, asserted that Lula would have wanted the picture to be used, that she and Guy Sommet had been bosom friends. Lula loved Guy like a brother and would want him to pay his final tribute to her work and her beauty. This is an iconic shot that will live forever and will continue to keep Lula alive in the memories of we who loved her. Strike drank the last of his lager and contemplated the final four words of his sentence. He had never been able to understand the assumption of intimacy fans felt with those they had never met. People had sometimes referred to his father as Old Johnny in his presence, beaming as if they were talking about a mutual friend, repeating well-worn press stories and anecdotes as though they had been personally involved. A man in a pub in Triscothic had once said to Strike, "Fuck, I know your old man better than you do," because he was able to name the session musician who had played on the Deadbeat's biggest album and whose tooth Rokeby had famously broken when he slapped the end of his saxophone in anger. It was one in the morning. Strike had become almost deaf to the constant muffled thuds of the bass guitar from two floors below, and to the occasional creaks and hisses from the attic flat above, where the bar manager enjoyed luxuries like showers and home-cooked food. Tired, but not yet ready to climb into his sleeping bag, he managed to discover Guy Sommet's approximate address by further perusal of the internet, and noted the close proximity of Charles Street to Kentigern Gardens. Then he typed in the web address www.arse.co.uk, like a man turning automatically into his local after a long shift at work. He had not visited the Army Rumour Service site since Charlotte had found him months previously, browsing it on computer, and had reacted the way other women might had they found their partners viewing online porn. There had been a row, generated by what she took to be his hankering for his old life and his dissatisfaction with the new. Here was the Army mindset in its every particular, written in the language he too could speak fluently. Here were the acronyms he had known by heart, the jokes impenetrable to outsiders, every concern of service life, from the father whose son was being bullied at his school in Cyprus to retrospective abuse of the Prime Minister's performance at the Chilcot inquiry. Strike wandered from post to post, occasionally snorting in amusement, yet aware all the time that he was lowering his resistance to the spectre he could feel, now, breathing on the back of his neck. This had been his world, and he had been happy there. For all the inconveniences and hardships of military life, for all that he had emerged from the army minus half his leg, he did not regret a day of the time he had spent serving. And yet, he had not been of these people, even while among them. He had been a monkey, and then a suit, feared and disliked about equally by the average squaddy. If ever the SIB talked to you, you should say, "No comment, I want a lawyer." Alternatively, a simple, "Thank you for noticing me," will suffice. Strike gave a final grunt of laughter, and then, abruptly, shut down the site and turned off the computer. He was so tired that the removal of his prosthesis took twice the time it usually did. Chapter 9. On Sunday morning, which was fine, Strike headed back to the Yulu to shower. Once again, by consciously filling out his own bulk and allowing his features to slide, as they did naturally, into a scowl, he made himself sufficiently intimidating to repel challenges as he marched, eyes down, past the desk. He hung around the changing rooms, waiting for a quiet moment so that he would not have to shower in full view of any of the changing students, for the sight of his false leg was a distinguishing feature he did not want to impress on anybody's memory. Clean and shaven, he caught the tube to Hammersmith Broadway, enjoying the tentative sunshine gleaming through the glass-covered shopping precinct through which he emerged onto the street. The distant shops on King Street were heaving with people. It might have been a Saturday. This was a bustling and essentially soulless commercial centre, and yet Strike knew it to be a bare 10 minutes' walk to a sleepy, countrified stretch of the Thames embankment. While he walked, traffic rumbling past him, he remembered Sundays in Cornwall in his childhood, when everything closed down except the church and the beach. Sunday had had a particular flavour in those days, an echoing, whispering quiet, the gentle chink of china and the smell of gravy, the TV as dull as the empty high street, and the relentless rush of the waves on the beach when he and Lucy had run down onto the shingle, forced back onto primitive resources. His mother had once said to him, "If Joan's right and I end up in hell, it'll be eternal Sunday in bloody St. Maur's." Strike, who was heading away from the commercial centre towards the Thames, phoned his client as he walked.
"John Bristow?"
"Yeah, sorry to disturb you at the weekend, John."
"Cormoran," said Bristow, immediately friendly. "Not a problem, not a problem at all. How did it go with Wilson?"
"Very good, very useful, thanks. I wanted to know whether you can help me find a friend of Lula's. It's a girl she met in therapy. A Christian name begins with an R, something like Rachel or Raquel. And she was living at the St. Elmo Hostel in Hammersmith when Lula died. Does that ring any bells?"
There was a moment's silence. When Bristow spoke again, the disappointment in his voice verged on annoyance.
"What do you want to speak to her for? Tans is quite clear that the voice she heard from upstairs was male."
"I'm not interested in this girl as a suspect, but as a witness. Lula had an appointment to meet her at a shop, Vashti, right after she saw you at your mother's flat."
"Yeah, I know. That came out at the inquest. I mean, well, of course, you know your job, but I don't really see how she would know anything about what happened that night."
"Listen, wait a moment, Cormoran. I'm at my mother's and there are other people here. Need to find a quieter spot."
Strike heard the sounds of movement, a murmured, "Excuse me," and Bristow came back on the line.
"Sorry, I didn't want to say all this in front of the nurse.
Actually, I thought when you rang you might be someone else calling up to talk to me about Duffield. Everybody I know has rung to tell me."
"Tell you what?"
"You obviously don't read the News of the World. It's all there, complete with pictures. Duffield turned up to visit my mother yesterday, out of the blue. Photographers outside the house. It caused a lot of inconvenience and upset with the neighbours. I was out with Alison, or I'd never have let him in."
"What did he want?"
"Good question. Tony, my uncle, thinks it was money. But Tony usually thinks people are after money. Anyway, I've got power of attorney, so there was nothing doing there. God knows why he came. The one small mercy is that Mum doesn't seem to have realised who he is. She's on immensely strong painkillers."
"How did the press find out he was coming?"
"That," said Bristow, "is an excellent question. Tony thinks he phoned them himself.
How is your mother?
Poorly, very poorly. They say she could hang on for weeks, or it could happen at any moment.
I'm sorry to hear that, said Strike.
He raised his voice as he passed underneath a flyover across which traffic was moving noisily.
Well, if you do happen to remember the name of Lula's Vashti friend...
I'm afraid I still don't really understand why you're so interested in her.
Lula made this girl travel all the way from Hammersmith to Notting Hill, spent 15 minutes with her and then walked out. Why didn't she stay? Why meet for such a short space of time? Did they argue? Anything out of the ordinary that happens around a sudden death could be relevant.
I see, said Bristow hesitantly. But, well, that sort of behaviour wasn't really out of the ordinary for Lula. I did tell you that she could be a bit selfish. It would be like her to think that a token appearance would keep the girl happy. She often had these brief enthusiasms for people, you know, and then dropped them. His disappointment at Strike's chosen line of inquiry was so evident that the detective felt it might be politic to slip in a little covert justification of the immense fee his client was paying.
The other reason I was calling was to let you know that tomorrow evening I'm meeting one of the CID officers who covered the case, Eric Wardle. I'm hoping to get hold of the police file.
Fantastic! Bristow sounded impressed. That's quick work.
Yeah, well, I've got good contacts in the Met.
Then you'll be able to get some answers about the runner. You've read my notes.
Yeah. Very useful, said Strike.
And I'm trying to fix up a lunch with Tansy Bestigui this week, so you can meet her and hear her testimony firsthand. I'll ring your secretary, shall I?
Great.
There was this to be said for having an underworked secretary he could not afford, Strike thought, once he had rung off. It gave a professional impression. St. Elmo's Hostel for the Homeless turned out to be situated right behind the noisy concrete flyover. A plain, ill-proportioned and contemporaneous cousin of Lula's Mayfair house, red brick with humbler, grubby white facings, no stone steps, no garden, no elegant neighbours, but a chipped door opening directly onto the street, peeling paint on the window ledges, and a forlorn air. The utilitarian modern world had encroached until it sat huddled and miserable, out of sync with its surroundings, the flyover a mere 20 yards away, so that the upper windows looked directly out upon the concrete barriers and the endlessly passing cars. An unmistakably institutional flavour was given by the large silver buzzer and speaker beside the door, and the unapologetically ugly black camera with its dangling wires that hung from the lintel in a wire cage. An emaciated young girl with a sore at the corner of her mouth stood smoking outside the front door, wearing a dirty man's jumper that swamped her. She was leaning up against the wall, staring blankly towards the commercial centre barely 5 minutes' walk away, and when Strike pressed the buzzer for admission to the hostel, she gave him a look of deep calculation, apparently assessing his potentialities. A small, fusty, grimy-floored lobby with shabby wooden panelling lay just inside the door. Two locked glass panel doors stood to left and right, affording him glimpses of a bare hall and a depressed-looking side room with a table full of leaflets, an old dartboard, and a wall liberally peppered with holes. Straight ahead was a kiosk-like front desk, protected by another metal grille. A gum-chewing woman behind the desk was reading a newspaper. She seemed suspicious and ill-disposed when Strike asked whether he could speak to a girl whose name was something like Rachel and who had been a friend of Lula Landry's.
You a journalist?
No, I'm not. I'm a friend of a friend.
Should know her name then, shouldn't you?
Rachel, Raquel, something like that.
A balding man strode into the kiosk behind the suspicious woman.
I'm a private detective, said Strike, raising his voice, and the bald man looked around, interested. Here is my card. I've been hired by Lula Landry's brother, and I need to talk to...
Oh, you looking for Rachel?
Asked the bald man, approaching the grill.
She's not here, pal. She left.
His colleague, evincing some irritation at his willingness to talk to Strike, ceded her place at the counter and vanished from sight.
When was this?
It'd be weeks now. Couple of months, even.
Any idea where she went?
No idea, mate. Probably sleeping rough again. She's come and gone a good few times. She's a difficult character, mental health problems. Carrie Anne might know something, though. Hang on. Carrie Anne? Hey, Carrie Anne?
The bloodless young girl with a scabbed lip came in out of the sunshine. Her eyes narrowed.
What?
Rochelle, have you seen her?
Why would I want to see that fucking bitch?
So you haven't seen her?
Asked the bald man.
No, got a fag.
Strike gave her one. She put it behind her ear.
She's still around here somewhere. Janine said she'd seen her, said Carrie Anne. Rochelle reckons she got a flat or somewhat, lying fucking bitch. And Lula Landry left her everything. Not. What do you want Rochelle for?
She asked Strike, and it was clear that she was wondering whether there was money in it and whether she might do instead.
Just to ask some questions.
What about?
Lula Landry.
Oh,
said Carrie Anne, and her card-counting eyes flickered.
They weren't such big fucking mates. You don't want to believe everything Rochelle says, the lying bitch.
What did she lie about? Asked Strike.
Fucking everything. I reckon she stole half the stuff she pretended Landry bought her.
Come on, Carrie Anne,
said the bald man gently.
They were friends,
he told Strike.
Landry used to come and pick her up in her car. It caused,
he said, with a glance at Carrie Anne,
a bit of tension.
Not from me it fucking didn't, snapped Carrie Anne. I thought Landry was a fucking jumped-up bitch. She weren't even that good-looking.
Rochelle told me she's got an aunt in Kilburn,
said the bald man.
She done get on with her, though,
said the girl.
Have you got a name or an address for the aunt? Asked Strike.
But both shook their heads.
What's Rochelle's surname?
Oh, I don't know. Do you, Carrie Anne? We often know people just by their Christian names,
he told Strike. There was little more to be gleaned from them. Rochelle had last stayed at the hostel more than 2 months previously. The bald man knew that she had attended an outpatient's clinic at St. Thomas's for a while, though he had no idea whether she still went.
She's had psychotic episodes. She's on a lot of medication.
She didn't give a shit when Lula died, said Carrie Anne suddenly. She didn't give a flying fuck.
Both men looked at her. She shrugged, as one who has simply expressed an unpalatable truth.
Listen, if Rochelle turns up again, would you give her my details and ask her to call me?
Strike gave both of them cards, which they examined with interest. While their attention was thus engaged, he deftly twitched the gum-chewing woman's News of the World out of the small opening at the bottom of the grill and stowed it under his arm. He then bade them both a cheerful goodbye and left. It was a warm spring afternoon. Strike strode on down towards Hammersmith Bridge, its pale sage-green paint and ornate gilding picturesque in the sun. A single swan bobbed along the Thames beside the far bank. The offices and shops seemed 100 miles away. Turning right, he headed along the walkway beside the river wall and a line of low riverside terraced buildings, some balconied or draped in wisteria. Strike bought himself a pint in the Blue Anchor and sat outside at a wooden bench with his face to the water and his back to the royal blue and white frontage. Lighting a cigarette, he turned to page 4 of the paper, where a colour photograph of Evan Duffield, head bowed, large bunch of white flowers in his hand, black coat flapping behind him, was surmounted by the headline, Duffield's Deathbed Visit to Lula Mother. The story was anodyne, really nothing more than an extended caption to the picture. The eyeliner and the flapping greatcoat, the slightly haunted, spaced-out expression, recalled Duffield's appearance as he had headed towards his late girlfriend's funeral. He was described, in the few lines of type below, as troubled actor-musician Evan Duffield. Strike's mobile vibrated in his pocket, and he pulled it out.
he had received a text message from an unfamiliar number. News of the World, page 4, Evan Duffield, Robin. He grinned at the small screen before slipping the phone back in his pocket. The sun was warm on his head and shoulders, seagulls cawed, wheeling overhead, and Strike, happily aware that he was due nowhere and expected by no one, settled to read the paper from cover to cover on the sunny bench. Chapter 10. Robin stood swaying with the rest of the tightly packed commuters on a northbound Bakerloo tube train, everyone wearing the tense and doleful expressions appropriate to a Monday morning. She felt the phone in her coat pocket buzz and extricated it with difficulty, her elbow pressing unpleasantly into some unspecified flabby portion of a suited, bad-breathed man beside her. When she saw that the message was from Strike, she felt momentarily excited, nearly as excited as she had been to see Duffield in the paper yesterday. Then she scrolled down and read, "Out, key behind cistern of toilet, Strike." She did not force the phone back into her pocket, but continued to clutch it as the train rattled on through dark tunnels, and she tried not to breathe in the flabby man's halitosis. She was disgruntled. The previous day, she and Matthew had eaten lunch, in company with two university friends of Matthew's, at his favourite gastropub, the Windmill, on the Common. When Robin had spotted the picture of Evan Duffield in an open copy of the News of the World at a nearby table, she had made a breathless excuse right in the middle of one of Matthew's stories and hurried outside to text Strike. Matthew had said later that she had shown bad manners, and even worse, not to explain what she was up to, in favour of maintaining that ludicrous air of mystery. Robin gripped the hand strap tightly, and as the train slowed and her heavy neighbour leaned into her, she felt both a little foolish and resentful towards the two men, most particularly the detective, who was evidently uninterested in the unusual movements of Lula Landry's ex-boyfriend. By the time she had marched through the usual chaos and debris to Denmark Street, extracted the key from behind the cistern as instructed, and been snubbed yet again by a superior-sounding girl in Freddy Bestigui's office, Robin was in a thoroughly bad temper. Though he did not know it, Strike was, at that very moment, passing the scene of the most romantic moments of Robin's life. The steps below the statue of Eros were swarming with Italian teenagers this morning, as Strike went by on the St. James's side, heading for Glasshouse Street. The entrance to Barrack, the nightclub which had so pleased D.B. Mack that he had remained there for hours, fresh off the plane from Los Angeles, was only a short walk from Piccadilly Circus. The facade looked as if it was made out of industrial concrete, and the name was picked out in shining black letters, vertically placed. The club extended up over four floors. As Strike had expected, its doorway was surmounted by CCTV cameras, whose range, he thought, would cover most of the street. He walked around the building, noting the fire exits, and making for himself a rough sketch of the area. After a second long internet session the previous evening, Strike felt that he had a thorough grasp of the subject of D.B. Mack's publicly declared interest in Lula Landry. The rapper had mentioned the model in the lyrics of three tracks on two separate albums. He had also spoken about her in interviews as his ideal woman and soulmate. It was difficult to gauge how seriously Mack intended to be taken when he made these comments. Allowance had to be made, in all the print interviews Strike had read, firstly for the rapper's sense of humour, which was both dry and sly, and secondly for the awe tinged with fear every interviewer seemed to feel when confronted with him. An ex-gang member who had been imprisoned for gun and drug offences in his native Los Angeles, Mack was now a multimillionaire, with a number of lucrative businesses aside from his recording career. There was no doubt that the press had become excited, to use Robin's word, when news had leaked out that Mack's record company had rented him the apartment below Lula's. There had been much rabid speculation as to what might happen when D.B. Mack found himself a floor away from his supposed dream woman, and how this incendiary new element might affect the volatile relationship between Landry and Duffield.
These non-stories had all been peppered with undoubtedly spurious comments from friends of both. He's already called her and asked her to dinner. She's preparing a small party for him in her flat when he hits London. Such speculation had almost eclipsed the flurry of outraged comment from sundry columnists that the twice-convicted Mac, whose music, they said, glorified his criminal past, was entering the country at all. When he had decided that the street surrounding Barrack had no more to tell him, Strike continued on foot, making notes of yellow lines in the vicinity, of Friday night parking restrictions, and of those establishments nearby that also had their own security cameras. His notes complete, he felt that he had earned a cup of tea and a bacon roll on expenses, both of which he enjoyed in a small cafe while reading an abandoned copy of the Daily Mail. His mobile rang as he was starting his second cup of tea, halfway through a gleeful account of the Prime Minister's gaffe in calling an elderly female voter bigoted, without realising that his microphone was still turned on. A week ago, Strike had allowed his unwanted temps calls to go to voicemail. Today, he picked up.
"Hi, Robin. How are you?"
"Fine. I'm just calling to give you your messages."
"Far away," said Strike, as he drew out a pen.
"Alison Cresswell's just called, John Bristow's secretary, to say she's booked a table at Cipriani at 1 o'clock tomorrow so that he can introduce you to Tansy Bestigwi."
"Great."
"I've tried Freddie Bestigwi's production company again. They're getting irritated. They say he's in L.A. I've left another request for him to call you."
"Good."
"And Peter Gillespie's telephoned again."
"Uh-huh," said Strike.
"He says it's urgent, and could you please get back to him as soon as possible?" Strike considered asking her to call Gillespie back and tell him to go and fuck himself.
"Yeah, will do. Listen, could you text me the address of the nightclub Uzi?"
"Right.
And try and find a number for a bloke called Guy Sumay. He's a designer."
"It's pronounced Guy," said Robin.
"What?"
"His Christian name. It's pronounced the French way. Guy."
"All right. Well, could you try and find a contact number for him?"
"Fine," said Robin.
"Ask him if he'd be prepared to talk to me. Leave a message saying who I am and who's hired me."
"Fine." It was borne in on Strike that Robin's tone was frosty. After a second or two, he thought he might know why.
"By the way, thanks for that text you sent yesterday," he said. "Sorry I didn't get back to you. It would have looked strange if I'd started texting where I was. But if you could call Nigel Clements, Duffield's agent, and ask for an appointment, that would be great too."
Her animosity fell away at once, as he had meant it to. Her voice was many degrees warmer when she spoke again, verging, in fact, on excited.
"But Duffield can't have had anything to do with it, can he? He had a cast-iron alibi."
"Yeah, well, we'll see about that," said Strike,
deliberately ominous.
"And listen, Robin, if another death threat comes in, they usually arrive on Mondays."
"Yes," she said eagerly.
"File it," said Strike.
He could not be sure. It seemed unlikely she struck him as so prim. But he thought he heard her mutter, "Sod you, then," as she hung up. Strike spent the rest of the day engaged in tedious but necessary spade work. When Robin had texted him the address, he visited his second nightclub of the day, this time in South Kensington. The contrast with Barrack was extreme. Uzi's discreet entrance might have been to a smart private house. There were security cameras over its doors, too. Strike then took a bus to Charles Street, where he was fairly sure Guy Sommet lived, and walked what he guessed to be the most direct route between the designer's address and the house where Landry had died. His leg was aching badly again by late afternoon, and he stopped for a rest and more sandwiches before setting out for the Feathers near Scotland Yard and his appointment with Eric Wardle. It was another Victorian pub, this time with enormous windows reaching almost from floor to ceiling, looking out onto a great grey 1920s building decorated with statues by Jacob Epstein. The nearest of these sat over the doors and stared down through the pub windows. A fierce, seated deity was being embraced by his infant son, whose body was weirdly twisted back on itself to show his genitalia. Time had eroded all shock value. Inside the feathers, machines were clinking and jingling and flashing primary coloured lights. The wall-mounted plasma TVs, surrounded with padded leather, were showing West Bromwich Albion versus Chelsea with the sound off, while Amy Winehouse throbbed and moaned from hidden speakers. The names of ales were painted on the cream wall above the long bar, which faced a wide, dark wood staircase with curving steps and shining brass handrails leading up to the first floor. Strike had to wait to be served, giving him time to look around. The place was full of men, most of whom had military short hair. But a trio of girls with tangerine tans stood around a high table, throwing back their over-straightened peroxide hair in their tiny, tight, spangled dresses, shifting their weight unnecessarily on their teetering heels. They were pretending not to know that the only solitary drinker, a handsome, boyish man in a leather jacket, who was sitting on a high bar seat beside the nearby window, was examining them, point by point, with a practiced eye. Strike bought himself a pint of Doombar and approached their appraiser. "Cormoran Strike," he said, reaching Wardle's table. Wardle had the kind of hair Strike envied in other men. Nobody would ever have called Wardle pubehead.
"Yeah, I thought it might be you," said the policeman, shaking hands. "Anstis said you were a big bloke."
Strike pulled up a bar stool, and Wardle said, without preamble,
"What have you got for me, then?"
"There was a fatal stabbing just off Ealing Broadway last month. Guy called Liam Yates. Police informant, wasn't he?"
"Yeah, he got a knife in the neck. But we know who did it,"
said Wardle with a patronising laugh.
"Half the crooks in London know. If that's your information. Don't know where he is, though, do you?"
With a quick glance at the determinedly unconscious girls, Wardle slid a notebook out of his pocket.
"Go on." "There's a girl who works in Betbusters on the Acne Road called Shona Holland. She lives in a rented flat two streets away from the bookies. She's got an unwelcome house guest at the moment called Brett Fernie, who used to beat up her sister. Apparently he's not the sort of bloke you refuse a favour."
"Got the full address?" asked Wardle, who was scribbling hard. "I've just given you the name of the tenant and half the postcode. How about trying a bit of detective work?"
"And where did you say you got this?" asked Wardle, still jotting rapidly with the notebook balanced under the table on his knee.
"I didn't," replied Strike, equably, sipping his beer.
"Got some interesting friends, haven't you?"
"Very. Now, in a spirit of fair exchange..."
Wardle, replacing his notebook in his pocket, laughed.
"What you've just given me might be a crock of shit."
"It isn't. Play fair, Wardle."
The policeman eyed Strike for a moment, apparently torn between amusement and suspicion.
"What are you after, then?"
"I told you on the phone. Bit of inside information on Lula Landry."
"Don't you read the papers?"
"Inside information," I said. "My client thinks there was foul play."
Wardle's expression hardened.
"Hooked up with a tabloid, have we?"
"No," said Strike. "Her brother."
"John Bristow?"
Wardle took a long pull on his pint, his eyes on the upper thighs of the nearest girl, his wedding ring reflecting red lights from the pinball machine.
"Is he still fixated on the CCTV footage?"
"He mentioned it," admitted Strike.
"We tried to trace him," said Wardle. "Those two black guys. We put out an appeal. Neither of them turned up. No big surprise. A car alarm went off just about the time they would have been passing it, or trying to get into it. Maserati, very tasty."
"Reckon they were nicking cars, do you?"
"I don't say they went there specifically to nick cars. They might have spotted an opportunity, seeing it parked there. What kind of tosser leaves a Maserati parked on a street? But it was nearly 2 in the morning, the temperature was below zero, and I can't think of many innocent reasons why two men would choose to meet at that time in a Mayfair street where neither of them, as far as we could find out, lived.
No idea where they came from, or where they went afterwards. We're pretty sure the one Bristow's obsessed with, the one who was walking towards her flat just before she fell, got off the number 38 bus in Wilton Street at 11:15. There's no saying what he did before he passed the camera at the end of Bellamy Road an hour and a half later. He tanked back past it about 10 minutes after Landry jumped, sprinted up Bellamy Road and most probably turned right down Weldon Street. There's some footage of a guy more or less meeting his description. Tall, black, hoodie, scarf round the face, caught on Theobald's Road about 20 minutes later. "We made good time if he got to Theobald's Road in 20 minutes, commented Strike. "That's out towards Clerkenwell, isn't it? Must be 2, 2.5 miles, and the pavements were frozen." "Yeah, well, it might not have been him. The footage was shit. Bristow thought it was very suspicious that he had his face covered, but it was -10 that night, and I was wearing a balaclava to work myself. Anyway, whether he was in Theobald's Road or not, nobody ever came forward to say they'd recognised him." "And the other one?" "Sprinted off down Halliwell Street, about 200 yards down. No idea where he went after that. Or when he entered the area. Could have come from anywhere. We haven't got any other footage of him." "Aren't there supposed to be 10,000 CCTV cameras in London?" "They aren't everywhere yet. Cameras aren't the answer to our problems unless they're maintained and monitored. The one in Garryman Street was out, and there aren't any in Meadowfield Road or Hartley Street." "You're like everyone else, Strike. You want your civil liberties when you've told the missus you're at the office and you're at a lap dancing club, but you want 24-hour surveillance on your house when someone's trying to force your bathroom window open. Can't have it both ways." "I'm not after it either way," said Strike. "I'm just asking what you know about Runner 2. Muffled up to the eyeballs like his mate. All you could see were his hands. If I'd been him and had a guilty conscience about the Maserati, I'd have holed up in a bar and exited with a bunch of other people. There's a place called Bojo's off Halliwell Street you could have gone and mingled with the punters. We checked," Wardle said, forestalling Strike's question. "Nobody recognised him from the footage." They drank for a moment in silence. "Even if we'd found them," said Wardle, setting down his glass, "the most we could have got from them is an eyewitness account of her jumping. There wasn't any unexplained DNA in her flat. Nobody had been in that place who shouldn't have been in there." "It isn't just the CCTV footage that's giving Bristow ideas," said Strike. "He's been seeing a bit of Tansy Bestigui." "Don't talk to me about Tansy fucking Bestigui," said Wardle irritably. "I'm going to have to mention her because my client reckons she's telling the truth." "Still at it, is she? Still hasn't given it up? I'll tell you about Mrs. Bestigui, shall I?" "Go on," said Strike, one hand wrapped around the beer at his chest. "Carver and I got to the scene about 20-25 minutes after Landry hit the road. Uniformed police were already there. Tansy Bestigui was still going strong with the hysterics when we saw her, gibbering and shaking and screaming that there was a murderer in the building. Her story was that she got up out of bed around 2 and went for a pee in the bathroom. She heard shouting from 2 flats above and saw Landry's body fall past the window. Now, the windows in those flats are triple glazed or something. They're designed to keep the heat and the air conditioning in and the noise of the hoi polloi out. By the time we were interviewing her, the street below was full of panda cars and neighbours, but you'd never have known it from up there except for the flashing blue lights. We could have been inside a fucking pyramid for all the noise that got inside that place. So I said to her, 'Are you sure you heard shouting, Mrs. Bestigui? Because this flat seems to be pretty much soundproofed.' She wouldn't back down. Swore she'd heard every word. According to her, Landry screamed something like, 'You're too late.' And a man's voice said, 'You're a fucking liar.' Auditory hallucinations, they call them," said Wardle. "You start hearing things when you snort so much coke your brain start dribbling out your nose." He took another long pull on his pint. "Anyway, we proved beyond doubt she couldn't have heard it. The Bestiguis moved into a friend's house the next day to get away from the press, so we put a few blokes in their flat and a guy up on Landry's balcony shouting his head off. The lot on the first floor couldn't hear a word he was saying, and they were stone-cold sober, and making an effort.
But while we were proving she was talking shit, Mrs. Bastigui was phoning Arthur London to tell him she was the sole witness to the murder of Lula Landry. The press were already onto it, because some of the neighbours had heard her screaming about an intruder. Papers had tried and convicted Evan Duffield before we even got back to Mrs. Bastigui. We put it to her that we'd now proven she couldn't have heard what she said she'd heard. Well, she wasn't ready to admit it had all been in her own head. She'd got a lot riding on it now, with the press swarming outside her front door like she was Lula Landry reborn. So she came back with, "Oh, didn't I say? I opened them. Yeah, I opened the windows for a breath of fresh air." Wardle gave a scathing laugh. "Sub-zero outside and snowing." "And she was in her underwear, right?" "Looking like a rake with two plastic tangerines tied to it," said Wardle. And the simile came out so easily that Strike was sure he was far from the first to have heard it. We went ahead and double-checked the news story. We dusted for prints, and right enough, she hadn't opened the windows. No prints on the latches or anywhere else. The cleaner had done them the morning before Landry died, and hadn't been in since. As the windows were locked and bolted when we arrived, there's only one conclusion to be drawn, isn't there? Mrs. Tansy Bastigui is a fucking liar. Wardle drained his glass. "Have another one," said Strike, and he headed for the bar without waiting for an answer. He noticed Wardle's curious gaze roaming over his lower legs as he returned to the table. Under different circumstances, he might have banged the prosthesis hard against the table leg and said, "It's this one." Instead, he set down two fresh pints and some pork scratchings, which to his irritation were served in a small white ramekin, and continued where they had left off. "Tansy Bastigui definitely witnessed Landry falling past the window, though, didn't she? Because Wilson reckons he heard the body fall right before Mrs. Bastigui started screaming. Maybe she saw it, but she wasn't having a pee. She was doing a couple of lines of Charlie in the bathroom. We found it there, cut and ready for her." "Left some, had she?" "Yeah. Presumably the body falling past the window put her off." "The window was visible from the bathroom?" "Yeah, well, just." "You got there pretty quickly, didn't you?" "Uniform lot were there in about 8 minutes, and Carver and I were there in about 20. Wardle lifted his glass, as though to toast the force's efficiency. "I've spoken to Wilson, the security guard," said Strike. "Yeah, he didn't do bad," said Wardle, with a trace of condescension. "It wasn't his fault he had the runs. But he didn't touch anything, and he did a proper search right after she jumped. Yeah, he did all right. He and his colleagues were a bit lazy on the door codes." "People always are. Too many PIN numbers and passwords to remember. Know the feeling. Bristow's interested in the possibilities of the quarter of an hour when Wilson was in the bog. We were too for about 5 minutes, before we'd satisfied ourselves that Mrs. Bastigui was a publicity-mad cokehead. Wilson mentioned that the pool was unlocked. Can he explain how a murderer got into the pool area, or back to it, without walking right past him?" "A fucking pool," said Wardle. "Nearly as big as the one I got at my gym, and all for the use of three fucking people. A gym on the ground floor behind the security desk. Underground fucking parking. Flats done up with marble and shit like a fucking five-star hotel." The policeman sat shaking his head very slowly over the unequal distribution of wealth. "Different world," he said. "I'm interested in the middle flat," said Strike. "DB Max," said Wardle. And Strike was surprised to see a grin of genuine warmth spread across the policeman's face. "What about it? Did you go in there?" "I had a look, but Bryant had already searched it. Empty. Windows bolted, alarm set and working properly." "Is Bryant the one who knocked into the table and smashed a big floral arrangement?" Wardle snorted. "Heard about that, did you? Mr. Bastigui wasn't too chuffed about it. Oh, yeah. 200 white roses and a crystal vase the size of a dustbin. Apparently he'd read that Mac asks for white roses in his rider." "His rider," Wardle said, as though Strike's silence implied an ignorance of what the term meant. "Stuff they ask for in their dressing rooms. I'd have thought you'd know about this stuff."
Strike ignored the insinuation. He had hoped for better from Anstis. Ever find out why Bestigui wanted Mac to have roses? Just smoozing, wasn't it? Probably wanted to put Mac in a film. He was fucked off to the back teeth when he heard Bryant had ruined him, yelling the place down when he found out. Anyone find it strange that he was upset about a bunch of flowers when his neighbours lying in the street with their head smashed in? He's one obnoxious fucker, Bestigui, said Wardle, with feeling. Used to people jump into attention when he speaks. He tried treating all of us like staff till he realised that wasn't clever. But the shouting wasn't really about the flowers. He was trying to drown out his wife, give her a chance to pull herself together. He kept forcing his way in between her and anyone who wanted to question her. Big guy as well, old Freddy. What was he worried about? That the longer she bawled and shook like a frozen whippet, the more bloody obvious it became that she'd been doing coke. He must have known it was lying around somewhere in the flat. He can't have been delighted to have the Met come bursting in. So he tried to distract everyone with a tantrum about his 500 quid floral arrangement. I read somewhere that he's divorcing her. I'm not surprised. He's used to the press tiptoeing round him because he's such a litigious bastard. He can't have enjoyed all the attention he got after Tansy shot her mouth off. The press made hay while they could, rehashed old stories about him throwing plates at underlings, punches in meetings. They say he paid his last wife a massive lump sum to stop her talking about his sex life in court. He's pretty well known as a prize shit. You didn't fancy him as a suspect? Oh, we fancied him a lot. He was on the spot and he's got a rep for violence. It never looked likely, though. If his wife knew that he'd done it or that he'd been out of the flat at the moment Landry fell, I'm betting she'd have told us so. She was out of control when we got there. But she said he'd been in bed and the bedclothes were disarranged and looked slept in. Plus, if he'd managed to sneak out of the flat without her realising it and gone up to Landry's place, we're left with the problem of how he got past Wilson. He can't have taken a lift, so he'd have passed Wilson in the stairwell coming down. So the timings rule him out. Wardle hesitated. Well, it's just possible. Just. Assuming Bestigui can move a damn sight faster than most men of his age and weight, and that he started running the moment he pushed her over. But there's still the fact that we didn't find his DNA anywhere in the flat, the question of how he got out of the flat without his wife knowing he'd gone, and the small matter of why Landry would have let him in. All her friends agreed she didn't like him. Anyway, Wardle finished the dregs of his pint. Bestigui's the kind of man who'd hire a killer if he wanted someone taken care of. He wouldn't sully his own ends. Another one? Wardle checked his watch. My shout, he said, and he ambled up to the bar. The three young women standing around the high table fell silent, watching him greedily. Wardle threw them a smirk as he walked back past with his drinks, and they glanced over at him as he resumed the bar stool beside Strike. How do you think Wilson shapes up as a possible killer? Strike asked the policeman. Badly, said Wardle. He couldn't have got up and down quickly enough to meet Tansy Bestigui on the ground floor. Mind you, his CV's a crock of shit. He was employed on the basis of being ex-police, and he was never in the force. Interesting. Where was he? He's been knocking around the security world for years. He admitted he'd lied to get his first job about 10 years ago, and he just kept it on his CV. He seems to have liked Landry. Yeah. He's older than he looks, said Wardle, inconsequentially. He's a grandfather. They don't show age like us, do they, Afro-Caribbeans? I wouldn't have put him as any older than you. Strike wondered idly how old Wardle thought he was. You got forensics to check out her flat? Oh, yeah, said Wardle. But that was purely because the higher-ups wanted to put the thing beyond reasonable doubt. We knew within the first 24 hours it had to be suicide. We went the extra mile, though, with the old fucking world watching. He spoke with poorly disguised pride. The cleaner had been through the whole place that morning. Sexy Polish girl. Crap English, but bloody thorough with a duster. So the day's print stood out good and clear. Nothing unusual. Wilson's prints were in there, presumably, because he searched the place after she fell. Yeah, but nowhere suspicious.
So as far as you're concerned, there were only three people in the old building when she fell. D.B. Mack should have been there, but...
He went straight from the airport to a nightclub, yeah, said Wardle.
Again, a broad and apparently involuntary grin illuminated his face.
I interviewed D.B. at Claridge's the day after she died. Massive bloke. Like you, he said, with a glance at Strike's bulky torso. Only fit.
Strike took the hit without demur.
Proper ex-gangster. He's been in and out of the nick in L.A. He nearly didn't get a visa to get into the U.K.
He had an entourage with him, said Wardle. All hanging around the room, rings on every finger, tattoos on their necks. He was the biggest, though.
One scary fucker, D.B.'d be if you met him down an alleyway. Politer than Bastigui by 10 fucking miles. Asked me how the hell I could do my job without a gun.
The policeman was beaming. Strike could not help drawing the conclusion that Eric Wardle, CID, was, in this case, as starstruck as Kieran Colovis-Jones.
Wasn't a long interview, seeing as he'd only just got off a plane and never set foot inside Kentigern Gardens. Routine. I got him to sign his latest CD for me at the end, Wardle added, as though he could not help himself. That brought the house down. He loved it. The missus wanted to put it on eBay, but I'm keeping...
Wardle stopped talking with an air of having given away a little more than he had intended. Amused, Strike helped himself to a handful of pork scratchings.
What about Evan Duffield?
Him, said Wardle. The stardust that had sparkled over the policeman's account of D.B. Mack was gone. The policeman was scowling. Little junky shit. He pissed us around from start to finish. He went straight into rehab the day after she died.
I saw.
Where?
Priory. Where else? Fucking rest cure.
So when did you interview him?
Next day. But we had to find him first.
His people were being as obstructive as possible. Same story as Bastigui, wasn't it? They didn't want us to know what he'd really been doing.
My missus, said Wardle, scowling even harder, thinks he's sexy.
You married?
No,
said Strike.
Anstis told me you left the army to get married to some woman who looks like a supermodel.
What was Duffield's story once you got to him?
They'd had a big bust-up in the club, Uzi. Plenty of witnesses to that. She left, and his story was that he followed her, about 5 minutes later, wearing this fucking wolf mask. It covers the whole head. Lifelike, hairy thing. He told us he got it from a fashion shoot.
Wardle's expression was eloquent of contempt.
He liked putting this thing on to get in and out of places, to piss off the paparazzi. So after Landry left Uzi, he got in his car, he had a driver outside waiting for him, and went to Kentigern Gardens.
Driver confirmed all that.
Yeah, all right.
Wardle corrected himself impatiently. He confirmed that he drove a man in a wolf's head who he assumed was Duffield, as he was of Duffield's height and build, and wearing what looked like Duffield's clothes, and speaking in Duffield's voice to Kentigern Gardens.
But he didn't take the wolf head off on the journey.
It's only about 15 minutes to her flat from Uzi.
No, he didn't take it off. He's a childish little prick.
So then... By Duffield's own account, he saw the paps outside a flat and decided not to go in after all. He told the driver to take him off to Soho, where he let him out. Duffield walked round the corner to his dealer's flat in Darbley Street, where he shot up.
Still wearing the wolf's head?
No, he took it off there, said Wardle.
The dealer, name of Wycliffe, is an ex-public schoolboy with a habit way worse than Duffield's. He gave a false statement agreeing that Duffield had come round at about 2:30. It was only the pair of them there, and yeah, I take long odds that Wycliffe would lie for Duffield, but a woman on the ground floor heard the doorbell ring and says she saw Duffield on the stair. Anyway, Duffield left Wycliffe's around 4 with a bloody wolf's head back on and rambled off towards the place where he thought his car and driver were waiting, except that the driver was gone. The driver claimed a misunderstanding. He thought Duffield was an arsehole. He made that clear when we took his statement. Duffield wasn't paying him. The car was on Landry's account. So then Duffield, who got no money on him, walks all the way to Chiara Porter's place in Notting Hill.
We found a few people who'd seen a man wearing a wolf's head strolling along relevant streets, and there's footage of him cadging a free box of matches from a woman in an all-night garage.
Can you make out his face?
No, because he only shoved the wolf's head up to speak to her, and all you can see is its snout. She said it was Duffield, though. He got to Porter's around 4:30. She let him sleep on the sofa, and about an hour later she got the news about Landry being dead and woke him up to tell him. Cue histrionics and rehab.
You check for a suicide note? Asked Strike.
Yeah. There was nothing in the flat, nothing on her laptop, but that wasn't a surprise. She did it on the spur of the moment, didn't she? She was bipolar. She'd just argued with that little tosser and it pushed her over. Well, you know what I mean.
Wardle checked his watch and drained the last of his pint.
I'm going to have to go. The wife will be pissed off. I told her I'd only be 1/2 hour.
The overtanned girls had left without either man noticing. Out on the pavement, both lit up cigarettes.
I hate this fucking smoking, Ben, said Wardle, zipping his leather jacket up to the neck.
Have we got a deal, then? Asked Strike. Cigarette between his lips, Wardle pulled on a pair of gloves.
Well, I dunno about that.
Come on, Wardle, said Strike, handing the policeman a card, which Wardle accepted as though it were a joke item. I've given you Brett Fearney.
Wardle laughed outright.
Not yet, you haven't.
He slipped Strike's card into a pocket, inhaled, blew smoke skywards, then shot the larger man a look compounded of curiosity and appraisal.
Yeah, all right. If we get Fearney, you can have the file.